thank you so much for coming out tonight to what I hope will be an enjoyable share. I want to thank Pam and Eitan for hosting. That was really very nice of you. You can clap. I want to thank Heather for making the copies, because there we go. And I want to thank the sponsors for the program, Pam and Eitan Klein, in memory of Pam's father, Steve Niger, Shlomo Aaron, Ben Yaakov, Bracha Rutner and Josh Muscat, in honor, of me, okay? Rachel and Jeremy Marilis, in honor of the Torchiner and Schwab families, and all our hardworking Gaboim. And Karen and I dedicated it also in memory of my grandmother, Giselle Hausman, whose yard site is on Shmini Atzeres. We've got atmosphere. Okay. Karen sends her regrets. We discovered a leak in our kitchen sink 10 minutes before I came over here for the shear. So Karen and Rena can't make it, but I'll get them a recording. That's all. Our topic is the etrog of Bar Kokhba, the etrog, the official fruit of the Bar Kokhba revolt. And it's really a remarkable thing. We're going to be discussing a blend of history as well as basically Hashkafa, Jewish thought, a little bit about Mashiach. But it's really remarkable to understand the way that the etrog played a fundamental role as an inspiration for the Bar Kokhba revolt in the first century. First, we're going to go through some history just to understand what we're talking about, what the revolt was, and how the etrog figures into it. And then we're going to have to talk about why the etrog was so important. And I start out with this funny article in source number one. This is an article from Commentary Magazine from 1958. Called A Goodly Tree, Sacred and Profane History. They're talking here not about Bar Kokhba. They're actually talking about the way that Jews love their etrog, as seen through the eyes of one of the early members of the Catholic Church. 3rd to the 4th century, this fellow was a bishop, Methodios Eubulios. Look at the article here, number one. Is the etrog just an excuse for the Jews to exercise their passion for the difficult, for the formal, and above all, for argument? In other words, why is it that we insist that it has to be this fruit and that it has to be this way? The Torah just says the fruit of a beautiful tree or the beautiful fruit of a tree. Why do we insist that it has to be the etrog? Such a view that in fact is just because Jews are difficult has been expressed before. In the 4th century, for example, Methodios Eubulios, a Christian bishop and subsequent martyr, wrote that it was both shameful and foolish for the Jews to make such an issue over a lemon. Now, that's not quite what Methodios actually said. What they put in Commentary Magazine was not exactly what he was saying. I looked him up and brought it for you in source number two. Methodius' point, really, is that we, Jews, misunderstood what our Torah was trying to tell us. He, the Christian, was going to tell us what the Torah was saying. And his view of it is that the Arba Minim, those four species, are not actually fruits. What they're actually meant to be is a representation of values that relate to an ultimate judgment and resurrection. If you take a look at number two, we're not going to spend a lot of time on Christian philosophy, but what he suggests is that you can read the Psukim in Parshas Emor, which give us the list of the four species, as relating to four different traits. So the just jumping to the bottom of the of this paragraph. After the three dots, after the ellipsis, or right before that, I suppose. He says, the Jews think that the most beautiful fruit of wood is the citron wood on account of its size. If the citron appear beautiful to you, why not the pomegranate and other fruits of trees, and amongst them apples, which much surpass the citron? Indeed, in the Song of Songs, Solomon, having made mention of all these fruits, passes over in silence the citron only. He says esrog doesn't make it into Shir HaShirim. If really we considered the esrog to be such an important fruit, wouldn't it be in Shir HaShirim, in Song of Songs? There are those who argue it is actually in Shir HaShirim, but I'm not going there. What I want to build on is this point that we do make a big deal out of the esrog. Evidently, we made a big deal out of the esrog in the 3rd and 4th century when this church father was complaining about the fact that we take the esrog to be this particular fruit. And we're going to see it was a big deal in Bar Kokhba's time a couple of centuries earlier. And again, what I want to ask is, why is it that the esrog has been so important to us? Why was it so important then? What are we supposed to get from this when we hold the Arba Minim on Sukkot? Clear? Good? Okay. So, a little bit of history of the Bar Kokhba revolt. Most of the records we have of the revolt actually come not from us, but from Roman historians who wrote about it. Bar Kokhba's documents tend to be very bureaucratic, very government-oriented. They're not really military. They don't give us a lot of history. It's more like administrative stuff. It's the Romans who give you the military history, presumably because that's what fascinated them. But the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed by the Romans in the year 68 or 70 of the Common Era. We go back and forth in terms of that date. However, you have Jews who are already in revolt from before that, living outside of Israel. And after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, those revolts continue in Israel and beyond. So, for example, in the 110s or so, 40 years after the Beis HaMikdash has been destroyed, we find a battle between Jews living in North Africa and their neighbors who are citizens of the Roman Empire. It was an ongoing thing. And Bar Kokhba starts his revolt in the year 131. It runs until the year 135. When in the year 135 did it end? We do know the date. Tisha B'Av, right. Tisha B'Av in the year 135 is when the Beitar fortress is crushed. And the Mishnah that lists the five different terrible things that happened on Tisha B'Av, one of them is the fall of the fortress of Beitar. Beitar was actually the last fortress to fall. We had a series of fortresses, and and unfortunately the Romans take them one by one, and Beitar is the last one. It was located southwest of Yerushalayim, about 7 miles southwest of Yerushalayim. It was at the top of a hill, 2,300 feet above sea level. So it's way, way up, and the idea being, of course, that way you're able to repel invasion. It was so large that the walls that remain of Beitar enclose an area 8.7 acres. It's a very large space. So Bar Kokhba's revolt has religious support. Who was the big name among the rabbis of the time who supported Bar Kokhba? Right, Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva was the big supporter of Bar Kokhba. He believed that Bar Kokhba could actually be Mashiach, and that was the support that he lent to him. The name itself, his original name, was not Bar Kokhba. It was actually believed to be, based on the letters that he sent, Shimon ben Kozba. Kozba is spelled Kaf Vav Samach Beis Aleph. That was his given name. Rabbi Akiva calls him Bar Kokhba, meaning son of the star. Son of the star. If you take a look at the Medrash in source number 3. Rabbi Akiva karavachama leilahadein Bar Koziva. When Rabbi Akiva saw this Bar Koziva, we'll see why they called him Bar Koziva in a minute. But when Rabbi Akiva saw this Bar Koziva, Hava Amar Hainu Malka Mashiach, he used to say, "This is the king, this is Mashiach." And then Rabbi Yochanan ben Torta replied, "Akiva," on a first name basis, "Yalu Asavim Bilchayayach Vadayin in Obai." He says, "Grass will grow in your jaws before he comes, before Mashiach gets here." That was Yeah, the party pooper there. But Rabbi Akiva believed that this was going to be Mashiach. The Rambam brings this in source number 4. The Rambam's Hilchos Malachim, in his Laws of Kings, he says, Al Yal Al Datacha, don't imagine that Mashiach has to perform signs and wonders. Mashiach doesn't have to make miracles. He doesn't have to create new things. He doesn't have to bring the dead back to life. It's not so. And the Rambam says, I'll prove it to you. Rabbi Akiva thought that this Ben Koziva could be Mashiach. And it wasn't so. He died. He was killed. And then they said, oh, I guess he's not Mashiach. And they moved on from there. But but what we get here is that the name Bar Kokhba, son of the star, was a name for someone who could be Mashiach. There's a prediction in the Torah from Bilam, Darach Kochav mi Yaakov, the star will come forth from Yaakov. That's supposed to be a reference to Mashiach. The other name he's given, we've seen it already, is Ben Koziva. What is in modern Hebrew? Lehit Achzev. Anybody know? Right, to be disappointed. Lehit Achzev is to be disappointed. Kazav is a lie or a disappointment. Bar Koziva was what they called him when his promise did not carry through. When it turned out that this was not Mashiach, then they called him the lie, or they called him the disappointment. But before his collapse, before the end of Beitar, he was amazing. They tell incredible stories about his personal strength and the might of the warriors he had with him. I brought you a couple of sources in 5 and 6 just to show you. A passage from the Talmud Yerushalmi says, Hayel Masayim Elef Matife Etzba. He had 200,000 soldiers who were missing a finger. Anybody know this story? You've heard this story? It's a little gruesome. Sorry for people who took sushi. Shochu Chachamim Va'omr. What he used to do, the Yerushalmi doesn't actually make it explicit. It was a test of the commitment of a warrior. Would they be willing to lose a finger? Which is a little counterintuitive when you think about what you need out of your warriors. But nonetheless, that was a test of their courage. And the Chachamim said, you know, you're taking all of these Jews and you're blemishing them. You're crossing them, their fingers. And he said, well, I need some way to test them. So the Chachamim said, well, how about this? They're riding on their horses and they have to be able to uproot a cedar tree while they're riding. And let that be a test of their strength. And he said, oh, you know, maybe that is better than cutting off their fingers. And now he had a new loyalty test. But that's one passage in the Yerushalmi. The other one is source number 6, the Medrash in Yalkut Shimoni, which describes Bar Kokhba himself catching stones from Roman catapults and throwing them back. The passage says he caught it in his arkuva. Arkuva can be a knee, it could also be an elbow. It's a joint of some kind. But he's clearly very mighty, unless you say, okay, fine, but these are Jewish stories about a Jewish warrior. And so, you know, obviously we're exaggerating when we talk about our own. But you look at source number 7 from Dio Cassius. Dio Cassius was the Roman historian of the time who gives us a lot of detail about the Bar Kokhba revolt. And look what he has to say about the fall of Beitar. He says, very few of them, in fact, survived. Them meaning us. Very few Jews survived the fall of Beitar. 50 of their most important outposts and 985 of their most famous villages were razed to the ground. 580,000 men were slain in the various raids and battles. And the number of those who perished by famine, disease, and fire was past finding out. Many Romans, moreover, perished in this war. Therefore, Hadrian, in writing to the Senate, did not employ the opening phrase commonly affected by the emperors, if you and your children are in health, it is well, I and the legions are in health. Number one, the tremendous numbers he describes. The Talmud has the big numbers when it describes those who fell at Beta, but even the Romans are talking about more than 500,000 people in battle, 50 fortresses. And the key line is that when Hadrian reports to the Senate, he doesn't say, I and the army are well. They're not well. They suffered heavy, heavy losses at the hands of Bar Kokhba during the 3.5-year revolt. So that's just background on the revolt itself. So far, so good? Okay. I mean, it's not good. It's bloody and whatever, but okay, fine. Let's go to the Esrog. So the first piece of evidence that tells us about the place of the Etrog in the Bar Kokhba revolt is in the coins. The coins of Bar Kokhba actually make it into the Gemara. The Gemara talks about Bar Kokhba's coins. So an example of that is source number 8. There is a halacha called Maaser Sheni. Maaser Sheni is a tithe which is supposed to be brought to Yerushalayim 4 years out of every 7, and you use it to buy food. Either you bring your produce there and you eat the produce in Yerushalayim, or you redeem the produce for money. You bring the money to Yerushalayim and you buy food in Yerushalayim. And the question is, which coins are usable to redeem this Maaser Sheni tithe? And source number 8 says that after the Bar Kokhba revolt collapsed, his coins could no longer be used to redeem this tithe. But this tells you that in general, like, these were a known thing and everybody was using them. They were around in general, and before the revolt collapsed, that would have been their currency. The coins were marked with the words Shimon Nasi Yisrael. Shimon, the Prince of Israel. Shimon being, again, Bar Kokhba's first name. Some of them were also marked with Elazar Kohen Gadol, Elazar the High Priest. There's some debate as to exactly which one this was. And the coins had images of the Arbaminim, Lulav, Esrog, Hadas, Arava, and the Esrog especially. And I tried in source number 9 to give you the pictures from the paper that's mentioned there, Professor Rivka Ben Sasson, Botanics and Iconography, Images of the Lulav and the Esrog. I'm not sure. I hope it's clear on the page. The four species of plants which are taken in hand during the Sukkot festival are represented in Jewish art from its very inception. For example, on the coins that were struck during the fourth year of the first revolt against the Romans. That's before Bar Kokhba. They appear again on the coins marking the first and fourth years of the Bar Kokhba revolt and on clay oil lamps from the same period. So the first set of pictures there, figure 1, is from the revolt at the time of the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash, right after the destruction. And at least on my page, I can see on the left side, you get what looks like two bunches of lulav and hadasim and aravos. And on the right side, you can see very clearly in the middle, the esrog. That's figure number 1. Figure number 2 is from Bar Kokhba's revolt. And on the right, on the left side, you see what's supposed to be the Beis Hamikdash. On the right side, you get the Arba Minim. You get the four species with the Esrog in the middle. It's interesting to note, we said that Bar Kokhba's big backer was Rabbi Akiva. So there's a machlokas in the Mishnah, in the times of Rabbi Akiva, about how you take the Lulav and Esrog. If you take a look at source number 10, Rabbi Akiva says, one lulav, one esrog, one hadas, one arava. Right? We normally have how many hadasim? Three. And how many aravos? Two. Rabbi Akiva says no. He says one of each kind. That's what you have. If you look at the picture, it's a little hard on this page, but in figure 2, in source number 9, you have one lulav, one esrog, one hadas, one arava, because Bar Kokhba is certainly going to paskin like Rabbi Akiva. Oh, you know what? It's actually on the next page. You can see it. Sorry. Source number 11. I forgot I had that there. David Hendon is the one who makes this point. He quotes you Rabbi Akiva. And if you look at his coins, it's actually clearer. You see that on the right? So there's one lulav, and there's one esrog, and there's also one hadas and one arava. Okay. So that's number 1. We know that these four species are important because we see them on the coins of the Bar Kokhba revolt. But there's more, and it's more dramatic than just the currency of the time. You see it in letters that have been found. We're familiar with the Dead Sea Scrolls. So the Dead Sea Scrolls were found in Qumran, near the Dead Sea. And after the scrolls showed up, the Bedouins went looking for more scrolls. right? Because when you find these scrolls, and all the archaeologists and all of the scholars are willing to pay you top dollar in order to get a hold of the Dead Sea Scrolls, so you start hunting in caves. Maybe there are more scrolls around that we can then produce and we'll be able to sell. So in 1951, the Bedouins find documents in a cave in an area called Nahal Darga. And it's also near the Dead Sea. And it includes a letter of Bar Kokhba. Then in the early 1950s, and in Expedition 1960, they find more letters from the Bar Kokhba revolt in an area called Nahal Chever. Nahal Chever should be fascinating for an entirely different reason. Well, almost entirely different. It's not entirely different. It also relates to an old document. The oldest ksuba that we know of is the ksuba of a woman by the name of Babatha. It was from her second marriage, and it was found in Nahal Chever, and it's from the time of the end of the second Beis HaMikdash. And it basically matches the ksuba that we use today, in principle. There are nuances of language, but yeah, it's the first century Common Era. So that's also found in this area in Nahal Chever. So two of the letters in this cache of documents relate to Lulav and Esrog. If you take a look at source number 12, this is from, you can see, Papyrus Yadin. Yigal Yadin. It's an Aramaic letter seeking Arba Minim for Sukkot. The letter is sent in number 12. I want to get to the point about like what all of this means as opposed to just doing the history. So I'm going to read out the English translation that I provided here. In the interest of time, Simon to Yehuda, son of Menashe. Simon is Shimon bar Kokhba, sending a letter to Yehuda bar Menashe to Kiryat Arabia. I have sent you two donkeys for you to send with them two men. I want you to send these donkeys along to Yehonatan, son of Be'en, and to Masabala to load them and send them to the camp. To you, palm branches and citrons. During the revolt against Rome, one of the things that Bar Kokhba apparently has to take care of personally, right, talk micromanager, takes care of personally is he's going to send the donkeys to go bring Lulav and Esrog, that everybody in Beitar should have Lulav and Esrog available. And send others from you, let them bring you myrtles and willow branches and prepare, I don't know if they came in plastic hermetically sealed bags, I don't know how that worked. Somebody standing there with a jeweler's loop, like, well, this one is a Behuder one, and this one is a Bar Kokhba great Esrog. And prepare them and send them to the camp, because the masses are many in peace. This is a letter that Bar Kokhba is sending himself, because he wants to be able to get Lulav and Esrog for everybody. That's one letter. The other letter is in number 13. This letter is not written in Hebrew, the letter is written in Greek, which is why I didn't bother to bring it on the page. I don't know if we have any Greek readers here. I'm not a Greek reader. I took a translation and just, accepted it as true. From Chaim Lapin, who is the author of Palm Fronds and Citrons. The letter is not written this time by Bar Kokhba. It's written by somebody named Sumayos. There was a historian who thought that it actually was Bar Kokhba, that Sumayos was like Shimon, but that makes no sense, as you'll see in a second. Sumayos sends his letter to Jonathan, son of Bayanos, and to Masabala. Greetings. Since I have sent Agrippa to you, hurry and send me wands and citrons. That's their translation. Wands, I assume they mean the lulav. Provide these for the camp of the Jews. Do not do otherwise. It was written in Greek because of no means having been found to write it in Hebrew. In other words, this guy Sumayos doesn't know Hebrew. He's writing in Greek, so he doesn't know Hebrew. So clearly it's not Bar Kokhba, because we know Bar Kokhba knows Hebrew. This is thought to be someone who was not Jewish, a Nabataean, who was an ally of the Jews. So the message is, again, we need Lulav and Esrog. So here's our question. It took us, 23 minutes to get here. Why is Lulav and Esrog such a big deal at this point for people who are engaged in what is literally a life and death struggle against the Romans? Like, why Lulav and Esrog? It's really remarkable. I'll tell you one thing, and then I'm going to ask you what you think, but I'll tell you one thing that people are not aware of. The Esrog was actually a luxury item in Rome. People ate Esrogim. That was a thing. Not like making it into like esrog jelly or whatever. Like people ate esrogim. If you take a look at source number 14, it's talking about after the end of Sukkos and Hoshanos and all of that. So immediately when they're done, Hatinokos shomten es lulaveya, and the children release their lulavim, va'ochlin esrogehen, and they eat the esrogim. And there's a story in source number 15 involving a Persian prince named Shabur Malka who had guests, and he brought them esrog to eat. And he cut and he ate some, and he cut more and he gave it to this other person. So people actually ate them, and they seem to have been considered a luxury item, especially because of their medical properties. The Latin name for esrog is citron medica, citrus medica, medica like medical. It was believed to have medical properties to it. I brought you source number 16 from an article, Citrus Fruits with a Clear Status, Symbols of the Nobility, the Ancient Mediterranean. There's even a Gemara that talks about a story in which there was someone who wasn't Jewish who dropped an esrog by accident into a Jew's wine, and the wine was not mevushel. And it raised questions about the kashrus of the wine. I remember the first time I learned that Gemara, I didn't know anything about the esrog being a luxury item in Rome. And I was like, why is a non-Jew holding an esrog? But the answer is because it was not just ours. It was a thing. So, okay, that's worth knowing about. But again, why would Bar Kokhba have prioritized Arba Minim and esrog? What would you say? Mystical properties to help in the war. That's a really interesting idea. I haven't come across anything with it, but knowing that it was believed to be medicinal, maybe. It's an interesting thought. I have to admit, I had not thought about that at all. Yeah? It's a mitzvah they could do. How many mitzvahs do you actually have available when you are, you know, you don't have a base on Mikdash, that's number one. And number two, you're under siege. You know, you're not leaving the fortress. So maybe this was just, here's our opportunity. And indeed, we know that Bar Kokhba's men were a religious group. We know they observed mitzvos. This same letter in which they talk about getting Arba Minim, getting the lulav and esrog, they also refer to truma and maser, to tithing produce properly. There's a Gemara in Yevamos, which I brought you in source number 17, where they talk about Bris Mila. They restored Bris Mila, Bar Kokhba's men. So it could just be, it's a mitzvah, we can do it, therefore we want to do it. On the other hand, like, they didn't send letters out for, like, matzah. Although maybe they could make their own matzah, right? I mean, they, you know, back in those days, you didn't send to Brooklyn for your matzah, you know? So maybe they just made their own matzah. I don't know. Yeah.
Well, maybe it's the symbolism of the mitzvah itself. You know, when you come to Sukkos after a whole Yom Kippur, pouring out your heart, and then you come, and you finally your tshuva is hopefully accepted, and we come reconnecting to something physical, and like with your sword held high, your lulav held high, this is how we're coming back, you know, in victory. And he's kind of leading a revolution, and it's a religious endeavor. So maybe this is to kind of give that idea some energy and say, we are a religious revolution, and here is our sword, and we're invested in this.
Right, good. So I'm going to come back to that, Razel. It's a great idea. I'm going to come back to it in a minute. Other ideas? Yeah.
It also connects to the land.
Connects to the land, meaning?
It connects to Eretz Yisrael, that, like, there are species that are in the land and that we have a strong connection to. So.
Right. Good. So I'm going to mention that one first just because it's in the order of my sources on the source sheet and it's good not to confuse people. But then I'm going to come back to the victory idea. The Romans reflected this idea that lulav and esrog were somehow symbolic of the Jewish people as a whole and the land of Israel. The date palm was considered to be a symbol of the Jewish people. If you take a look at source number 18 from Professor Ben Sasson's article, she writes, after the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, the Romans minted a coin to celebrate their victory, bearing the inscription Judea Capta, right? Captured Judea, where the symbol of Judea is a palm tree. under which sits a feminine figure guarded by a Roman soldier. Returning to the relatively few depictions of the date palm in mosaics of the land of Israel, I can make an assumption. In Jewish consciousness, the date palm represented Judea and its independence, as symbolized on the Roman coins of Judea Capta struck in Rome from 70 to 80 CE. I actually wonder, this is now just a thought that's occurring to me now and may have merit, may not have merit. Anyone here ever go to the reserve at Neot Kedumim? So one of the things they have there, I went on a UJA mission like 20 years ago, and they had something fascinating. There was a path that you walked going through it, and on one side they had a date palm, and on the other side they had a cedar. What would that image be? A date palm on one side, a cedar on the other side. Sorry? What's a date palm in Hebrew? Tamar. And the cedar is an Erez. Can you think of a pasuk with Tamar and Erez? Tzadik ha-tamar yifrach ke-erez balavanon yisgeh. Right? That the tzadik will flourish like the date palm and like the cedar. So they were trying to show you the date and the cedar together, because what David is doing in Tehillim is he's borrowing two very different images. The cedar grows up north. The date palm is tropical, more tropical. It's south, lower latitudes. And they were trying to sort of give you that image there. But my point in bringing this is maybe, the cedar of Lebanon is really not ours, so to speak. That's Lebanon up north. The date palm, on the other hand, would have been Israel. That Tamar is much more found in our own imagery, and it's something that would make sense. The cedar is up there, up north, and the date palm is Israel. So maybe that fits with the idea that they see the date palm as representing Eretz Yisrael. That's definitely a reason. But I want to come back to the victory point, because I find this fascinating. If you take a look at source number 19, Medrash in Tehillim, Va'ami Rabbanon, the sages said, the lulav in the right, and the esrog in the left, while walking around the mizbeach in the Beis Hamikdash, right? Hoshanos. Lulav in the right hand, esrog in the left hand. Matam, why do we hold a lulav and esrog as we march around? They quote you a pasuk from Tehillim. Ne'imos b'yemincha netzach. The pleasant items are in your right for victory. What does that refer to? Somebody who takes the lulav in the right hand is victorious with the branches. The one who takes the lulav in the right and is victorious with the branches. Customarily, competitors race in the arena, and who takes the branches? The one who wins. What are they referring to? The Roman races, right? And you have the wreath and all of that. So for us, the lulav and its species that go with it represent victory. When we march around the Mizbeach, it's supposed to be a victory parade. And what we're celebrating is victory on Yom Kippur. That's what we're doing. When we walk around with the lulav and esrog, we want to demonstrate victory on Yom Kippur. Interestingly, the Greeks actually saw parades with branches as a victory symbol. So, and I brought that for you in number 20. But this would then be a morale booster. Right? Imagine now Bar Kokhba. Bar Kokhba says, I want my troops to be able to visualize that we are defeating the Romans. So we are going to take the lulav and esrog, and we are going to march around with it in order to demonstrate that we have won. You follow? It's a huge morale boost for them. And then the last explanation, which I don't think negates any of the previous ones. I think these are complementary explanations. But Sukkot is linked very strongly with Mashiach. Sukkot is very much the Yom Tov of Mashiach. First of all, consider the year when the revolt is taking place. Right? We said that the revolt is between the year 131 and 135. It collapses in the year 135. How many years was it between the first Beis HaMikdash and the second? 70 years, correct. Yirmiyahu said it's going to be 70 years and then you're going to come back, and sure enough, that's what happened. 70 years. Beis HaMikdash is destroyed in the year 68. 70 years later is year 138. They're thinking to themselves, we're getting to the 70-year point. It's time for us to, again, rise and build a third Beis HaMikdash. That's in their mind, they're getting towards that. That's number one. But number two, in terms of Sukkot. So I brought you sources 21, 22, 23. These are psukim that are meant to highlight the Mashiach aspect. Source number 21 speaks to the dedication of the first Beis HaMikdash. The Beis HaMikdash was dedicated on Sukkot, right? It's dedicated in Tishrei, and the dedication ceremony runs through Sukkot. In Sefer Ezra, in source number 22, we find that when they build the second Beis HaMikdash, they do that as well. They set up the Mizbeach, and they start bringing their korbanos on Sukkot. And then the Navi Zechariah, in source number 23, we read this in the Haftorah on the first day of Sukkot, the Navi Zechariah has a vision as well of the nations coming to celebrate Sukkot in the Beis HaMikdash. So Sukkot is associated with that, right? You have this whole idea that on Sukkot we bring 70 bulls as part of the korbanos to represent each of the nations of the world. Any of you ever see the parade in Yerushalayim on Sukkot, right? The parade from the nations of the world, as all the different tourists come and they parade around Yerushalayim. That's what it's for, because of Zechariah's vision. So Sukkot in general is supposed to be a time associated with Mashiach. It makes sense that Bar Kokhba, who is very much riding this symbolism, wants to have the Sukkot imagery for his troops. There was an article in 1961 in a journal called Machanayim, in which Professor Shmuel Abramsky added a note. He said, Bar Kokhba took the title of Nasi. I mentioned that it was on his coins. That is the term that Yechezkel uses for Mashiach. Not only that, last note, source number 24, the causes of the Bar Kokhba revolt. In addition, the use of Paleo-Hebrew on the revolt coinage displays a desire to be seen like the Maccabees in their revolt as well, meaning we know that the Hebrew that we use today is not the original Hebrew alphabet. The original Hebrew alphabet, what he calls Paleo-Hebrew, is a much older alphabet, which the Gemara says Ezra replaces. That's called Paleo-Hebrew. That alphabet is used on the Bar Kokhba coins. Why is Bar Kokhba using that? Because those were the coins that the Maccabim used on their coins, and he's trying to channel that same spirit and that same fervor. So all of this to me, first of all, I like history, so it's interesting as a matter of history to see the significance of the Lulav and Esrog in Bar Kokhba's time. It was important for them at that point because it was a mitzvah. It was important to them at that point because the date palm in particular was a symbol of the land of Israel. It was important to them because this was a sign of victory and it would energize them. It was a morale booster. And it was also an emblem of the time of Mashiach. But beyond the history, it's important because we take the Lulav and Esrog and we think of the claim that we read in the very beginning in the first and second sources from this fellow Methodius, right? And his statement about these Jews who insist on this fruit and they make such a big deal about a lemon. But no, this is a big deal for us. It's a big deal as a mitzvah that we're able to fulfill. It's a big deal as a symbol of Eretz Yisrael. And it's a big deal as it's our sign of victory on Yom Kippur and an emblem for us of our hopes for the time of... But Chazal were realistic. They lived side by side with Amei Haaretz and Biryonim and Stukim and Baitusim. Yet they declared that we all sit in one sukkah, that we are one nation and not 70. We need their clear-eyed perception of what Jews are really like, and not to expect the unexpectable. Whether it is a lulav Jew whose heart is to